The lure of the open road is a strong one. For a lot of people, it's still exciting to take a car out on the highway and watch the landscape go whizzing past the windows. It helps if you have a dog there who's also sticking his tongue out there, too. That's the special stuff. On a daily basis, we probably take our vehicles for granted, expecting them to start when we're ready, stop when we press the brake, and not make too much noise in between. But things do go wrong with our vehicles. That's where Zach Edwards comes in. He knows cars and how to fix them. He's the owner of Ashland Automotive and our monthly guest on a segment we call The Squeaky Wheel. So here's your chance to ask some questions about how cars work these days or why yours doesn't. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Hi, Zach. Welcome back.
Hey, good morning.
So here we are in December, and the weather began acting boom like December right away. It got nice and freezing cold right away. Yeah, in fact, I had to scrape ice off my window this morning.
Yeah, it's crazy how quickly it happens.
So are there things that we should be, I know I ask this every year, but it's a good thing to know. I mean, are there things we should be changing about things we do to the car, put in the car, take out of the car, or have around the car during these cold months?
Well, there's some things to be aware of. Batteries right now is a big thing. The myth is that the cold weather is the worst thing for a battery, but it's really hot weather that's the worst thing for your battery. But cold weather would be the second worst thing. So cold weather is really going to push your battery. And so we see a lot of batteries starting to fail when temperatures dip into the 20s or even colder than that.
Just to the basic physics of that, though, is that because the engine is just harder to crank when the fluids are kind of jelly-like in there?
Yeah. Engine oil gets, it thickens with temperature and, you know, the viscosity, that rating 5W40, you're going to have a different viscosity when it's cold than when it's hot. And so it's more difficult to rotate. You know, think of it like the old airplane when you'd see a guy grab the propeller and pull the propeller down to start the airplane. That's what he was doing, is rotating the engine and getting it to fire up. And once it's fired up, it rotates on its own through the burning of the oil or the air and fuel mixture. So your starter is having to crank that engine over round and round. And, of course, the starter gets its power from the battery.
All right, so it's the engine. The battery is going to take some abuse from the cold weather itself, but it's also the fact that it's cranking an engine that's got a bit more inertia to it.
Yep, and the battery is measured. One of the statistics or one of the specifications of a battery is cold cranking amps, and that's exactly what that is. It's the ability of the battery to output amperage below a certain temperature.
So that speaks to constant temperatures that you're exposed to over the course of a winter. If you live, for example, in, say, Klamath Falls, should you maybe have a battery with a few more cold cranking amps than if you lived in Medford?
Well, actually, you know, the cold cranking amps, the specification for your car should be enough to handle a climate like Klamath Falls or like in the Midwest. As you know, much of the country experiences temperatures like Klamath Falls on a daily basis in the wintertime. We're pretty fortunate here on the West Coast where we have more mild temperatures. So you could certainly try and get a more beefier battery if you lived over in Klamath. And if you're asking if I would be inclined to do that, probably not, because a good quality battery at the specification that the car calls for should be plenty. You might have to change your battery a little more frequently over there. The typical battery is going to last you 5 to 7 years if it's been maintained properly. Now, battery maintenance, most
yeah,
of us...
You saw my face. Yeah, maintenance, yeah. Battery, what? What
am most I of us to do don't with? Do any battery maintenance, but if you wanted to... If
it
you're
says
wondering,
right on there, maintenance-free, Zach. Come
exactly, exactly. So think of like your battery. I always try and equate electricity to water because people understand water. And so think of your battery like a cup of water. When you go to start your car, it'd be like taking a sip out of the cup of water. And then once the car is running, the alternator drops some water back into the cup and fills it back up pretty quickly. Now, if you sit in a parking lot and listen to your radio for 2 hours with the dome light on, you're draining that cup of water all the way down as far as it can go before it runs out. And, you know, hopefully your car restarts. And if it does restart, your alternator is going to try and refill that cup of water. But it can't really, that's not its job to fill a cup all the way up from empty. Its job is to top off the cup. And so when I say battery maintenance, that if you were to do that, the right thing to do would be to then get your battery on a charger as soon as possible and fill it back up all the way. And if your battery is never really allowed to go empty like that, that's ideal for a car battery. And also, conversely, if the battery does go all the way empty, it's very not ideal for your alternator to have to work so hard to fill that cup of water or fill that battery back up. A lot of people, if they kill their battery, a lot of shops will say, oh, just go drive it on the highway and you'll charge the battery back
up.
Right,
I've heard that before.
Well, that works okay, but it's not actually, it's not ideal, and it doesn't charge the battery all the way up, and it's very hard on your alternator, and would most likely is going to shorten the life of your alternator. So okay. It won't kill your alternator that day, maybe. Maybe it will, but it's definitely going to be hard on that alternator, and down the road your alternator might fail earlier than it otherwise would have.
Zach Edwards, our guest again on the Jefferson Exchange in our segment, The Squeaky Wheel. He's the owner of Ashland Automotive, answering questions about car care and repair. You can join us on the Exchange. What's your car care issue? What's the worst situation you ever brought to a shop? We have some questions along those lines for Zach about some of the worst cases he's ever seen. Talk about the kinds of things that have happened to you and your vehicle over the years. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So the maintenance of the battery, as you talk about it, is about making sure you don't drain it too far. And if you do, actually put a real charge into it, mm-hmm. not just depend upon the car's own charging system to get it topped off again. What about stuff like when you get corrosion showing up around the terminals? What should you be doing with that?
With that, there's the old saying that you can use Coca-Cola. Any base really is going to work because that's an acid and you're trying to neutralize the base. That's a sulfuric acid. It's pretty nasty stuff.
In the battery, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's nasty to breathe. Oftentimes, if you're working around that, you'll start to taste it on the back of your throat, the taste of sulfuric acid. It's pretty repulsive. So it's definitely gnarly stuff, and it corrodes everything around it as well. It will begin to corrode the battery cable clamps. It will corrode the metal where the battery is sitting. There's, part of the body of the car, there's a little platform there for the battery tray. We've seen that become corroded and erode away to where it's just not there anymore.
And the corrosion will work its way up the cables too.
Yep, it'll work its way up the cables. And, once it gets that bad, oftentimes instead of a battery replacement, the customer then needs to pay for a thorough cleaning, battery replacement, cable end replacement, and sometimes the entire cable itself. So now you can imagine the expenses that go along with that.
So should you just take the Coca-Cola or
no,
or
just
the
a garden hose. I just use water.
Really?
Yep.
Just wash it off?
Yep. And you can buy, water is a fantastic base for an acid, and you thoroughly hose all that off. So the whole area, make sure you get the tray and anything down in that whole neck of the woods of the battery. And once you get all of the mountains of corrosion out of there, then you have to take the battery cables off the posts and clean in between there so that you're going to get back to having a really good connection. Because again, back to the water analogy, the alternator is trying to top off that battery, and how it, the pipe connecting the alternator to the battery is the cable and the clamp. And so if that pipe is corroded, it's basically like, think of it like a pipe being clogged inside, and the alternator is trying to squeeze a bunch of water through a pipe that's doesn't have as big of an opening as it's supposed to, so it's reducing the flow.
Okay, so some things to do to keep the corrosion from getting onto your battery. Zach Edwards is our guest. The segment is called The Squeaky Wheel. What's going on with your car? 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a question from Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, good morning. I'm wondering if I'm not willing to drag the battery out of my old beater truck that I just jumped a week or so ago. Can I just recharge that battery in the truck?
We're using what
with cables, with a jump, with a battery charger.
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. You can charge that. You don't need to take the battery out. You don't even need to disconnect the cable clamps if you don't want to, and if they're not corroded. So if you think that you're going to get a good connection from the outside of the clamp through to the post of the battery, then there's no need to take the battery out or disconnect anything. If you really want to clean it up, you know, taking the battery out is probably the best way. But also you can just disconnect a failsafe, or you know, the best method might be to just disconnect the cables and hook the charger right up to the battery, but there's no need to really remove the battery if the area is clean.
Okay, so as long as it's well maintained around there. Let's take another call from Masha in California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. My question is that my car makes a squealing, grinding sound that goes away once you hit about 2,000 RPMs.
Mm-hmm. Does it seem to respond to any other kinds of activity by you?
I mean, basically, I try and speed up as quick as I can to get to that 2,000 level for it to go away. And occasionally, it'll make it again when I slow down, but usually it's upon starting up.
Do you sometimes just rev the engine really high to try and get it to go away in the morning?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a squealing belt. It's very common when a belt is either worn out or just too loose. And what happens is by speeding up the engine, you're speeding up the rotational speed of that belt, and you're getting the belt hotter. And once the belt gets hotter, it's going to grab or be grabbed by whatever it's spinning with. And so in essence, it will stop slipping. And I would recommend you just take the car into any shop or your shop that you trust and tell them exactly what you said here, and they'll probably know right what to look for. And if tightening the belt doesn't work, then you're going to need a new belt, because what can happen is that rubber can become glazed. And once it becomes glazed, there's no more really friction to it. And so it's going to slip no matter how tight it is.
It's basically been burned over, in a sense, by getting stuck?
By friction. Mm-hmm. Just friction has smoothed. Mm-hmm. You know, really, the belt should be rotating with the pulley, mm-hmm, and not slipping. But if it, say, the belt became loose, then it was allowed to slip, then what can happen is the pulley can kind of glaze over the rubber on the belt, and then the belt has a real hard time grabbing traction even with the right tension. So one thing kind of leads to another, and then you'll just need to replace the belt.
Tighten the belt, and if necessary, replace the belt.
And sometimes I might add that, you know, the belts are moving with a lot of rotating components, and if you have one of those components that are supposed to rotate freely, say a bearing or an idler or tensioner bearing, think of it like a wheel that spins with the belt. If that wheel is starting to seize up and not move freely, that can also cause that. So it could be more problematic, but likely just looking at a loose belt or a belt that needs to be replaced.
All right, thanks for that call. Let's go to Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Zach Edwards and the squeaky wheel.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Good morning.
Preface this by saying I have an older car. I have a 1970s Datsun. And when I went to change or check the radiator fluid a couple of months ago, I noticed bits of rubber, the same as you see around the sealant that goes between the engine and the blade. I saw that in the fluid, and so I took it to the shop. And instead, and it hadn't been acting badly, and the temperature monitor had been working fine. They said I had a bad temperature monitor, and they changed that and flushed it and everything. And I brought it home, and it still continued to leak. So I changed the cap myself, and they said that all their tests show that it's not leaking, you know, the pressure tests.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered where I should proceed, because it's obvious that it's still leaking, and they never, I feel, dealt with some sort of sealant, you know, to the engine block itself. So suggestions?
Connie, which Datsun, first of all?
I have a 1978 510 station wagon.
78 510, okay, yeah. I took my driver's test in a 76 F10, so we're right down the same alley.
Hold
Thanks
on.
For that.
I might want to ask, so you mentioned you took your radiator cap off and you saw some black bits.
I didn't see black bits in there. I saw the rubber sort of orangey-red sealant. It's the same color as the stuff I see on the outside where the fan attaches to the engine.
Mm-hmm.
So these little strands, the sort of pinky red strands, were in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I told everyone about this and showed it to them.
Did it look like rusty water?
The water itself?
Yeah.
No. It still looked greenish.
Okay. Well, and so what's happening is the fluid is becoming low. You're just losing, the level is becoming low.
Yeah, it'll go down, you know. I put little markers, actually, on the reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I drive around town, I lose about half an inch to an inch.
Mm-hmm. And the shop you've brought it into, and they say they don't see anything leaking externally?
Not after they changed what was, you know, the gas, the temperature gauge and the gasket. That's a gasket-driven area, not a sealant, so I don't know how to impress upon them that obviously something else is happening.
Yeah, so, well, what they need to do next is they need to perform a test to determine if the head gasket is leaking. If the head gasket is leaking, what can happen is the cylinder head is sealed. It's kind of like the lid on the engine, and it needs coolant pumped into it, just like coolant is pumped around the engine. And the head gasket is responsible for keeping the coolant out of the internal combustion process of the air-fuel mixture. And what can happen when that gasket begins to leak, the coolant can leak into the internal combustion chamber and then basically gets burned with air and fuel mixture and pumped in the form of exhaust right out your tailpipe. And so
would that explain a lot of steaming out the tailpipe?
It would explain a lot of steaming. Now, there's steaming is normal on a cold morning, but it shouldn't. Once your car, it depends. I mean, it depends on how cold it is.
You're not likely to see steam coming out of the tailpipe.
Right.
Yeah.
But there's some tests that they can run. So one of them, and one good test is to just pull out your spark plugs and inspect them, and if you're losing as much coolant as it sounds like you're losing, a trained eye would be able to see that on a spark plug, because a spark plug's condition is indicative of what it is burning and how effectively it's burning it. And so a spark plug that's been burning antifreeze or coolant shows signs of that if it's been happening for quite some time. And another test that they can run is if they have an exhaust gas analyzer, they can sniff with the analyzer. It's like the old probe that they would stick in the tailpipe at the DEQ station.
Oh, yeah.
If they actually use that and sniff the vapor inside the radiator neck while the car is fully warmed up, oftentimes the machine will detect exhaust gases in the coolant, which tells you that there's been a breach of that head gasket.
You go both ways across the head gasket.
But sometimes they only go one way. So some of these tests are not conclusive. So they're probably going to want to run that test. They're going to want to run a look at the spark plugs. And then there's a couple other tests that they might want to run too. These can be really hard, especially on old cars. But they should believe you when you say that you're missing coolant. That's for sure.
It's pretty apparent.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Connie. Appreciate that. And best of luck. I hope it's not the head gasket. That can cost a few bucks to fix. So let's move on then to talk about some of the hardest cases you've ever had. It sounds like you ask the right questions right off the bat about the kinds of things that can tell you what's wrong with a car. But there've got to have been a few cases you had over the years that have been real stumpers.
Yeah, it's a really hard job, and communication is key, but ultimately we're not able to communicate with the car as much as we are with the owner. You know, the computer systems communicate, and they've made it a lot easier. But there was a time back when I worked at a car dealership where a car had this really bizarre problem, and it was multifaceted. You know, I think the passenger window would stop rolling down with the passenger window switch, but it would roll down fine with the driver's window switch, the master. And at the same time, the defrost wouldn't work, the air conditioning wouldn't work, and I think the stereo had a problem. And so all of these things would happen only randomly. And the customer had brought the car in, and I couldn't duplicate the concern. I couldn't get it to act up, and I would drive the car and drive the car and drive the car, and I couldn't get it to act up. And give the car back, and of course the customer would come back the next day. The problem would have happened again, and I would go and get in the car and drive it and drive it and drive it and couldn't get it to act up. And so I had been on the phone with the engineers of the vehicle manufacturer, and they were authorizing me to run all these tests. This was under warranty. It was a pretty new car. And So I was running all these tests and recording my results and creating this log of all of these things that I was doing. And I was on the phone with tech support every day. And I probably spent 30 or 40 hours on this, those are really stressful hours when you have a customer who really wants their car back.
Yeah.
They don't understand why you can't just fix the car. Can't you just plug the computer in and tell you what's wrong with it? And so I was really struggling, and I was a younger tech too at that time, and I was maybe just a few years out of school. And so I had all sorts of electrical knowledge, but not a lot of practical knowledge. It turns out it wouldn't have mattered because I was doing all the right things. And what it ended up being was that the driver of the car was about 6'6", and that's a foot taller than me.
Uh-huh.
And so I would get in. And normally I would never move the seat on a customer's car, but in this case, to drive the car, I had to move
the
seat.
Just to reach the pedals, yeah.
And so with the seat moved forward, the car didn't have the problem. There was a wire harness under the seat that went to a computer control module that was mounted under the seat. And that wire loom contained the data bus, which is kind of the communication highway for the whole car. And when the driver would move the seat all the way to the rear position, it would pull on that wire harness, and there was some chafing happening. And so an irregular signal would be put onto that data bus, uh-huh, and send whacked out signals to all these different parts of the car, like the power window, just for the passenger side.
So I'm just thinking that the next time you get a case like this, you have to ask the drivers, how tall are you?
Yeah.
Wow, that's an interesting case. I want to hear some more details of some of the tougher cases you've had over the years. It'll have to come in a future edition of The Squeaky Wheel. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive, our guest once a month to talk about car care. Always good to see you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Jeff.